First, I want to dispense a little bit with the typically long introductions you get from this kind of place and just tell you that Chris Steele, to my left, is the Executive Director of the Education and Employment Ministry and former Speaker of the Oklahoma House of Representatives, and he's from a far east Oklahoma City suburb called Shawnee, right?
Yes.
And Andrew Rice is the Executive Director of the Variety Care Foundation, recently returned to Oklahoma City after a brief move to Nashville and served in the Oklahoma Senate as Democratic leader. Welcome. Now, and I'm just going to take just a moment of personal privilege also before getting started, because I've had the opportunity to observe a lot of our state lawmakers in my tenure as news director at KGOU, and I came to appreciate these two in particular because, from my perspective, which I admit is limited, Andrew Rice and Chris Steele were able to really dwell in that sometimes difficult and conflictual arena we call the state capitol. And that, and also maintaining their personal integrity, which I thought was really amazing. And I should also note that, for those of you who don't know, that all three of us are actually theologically trained. So I thought about changing the subject from an examination of the political climate in Oklahoma to a discussion of the implication of the doctrine of original sin in a postmodern, process-relational, eschatological context.
You'd be on your own on that.
Yeah, okay. But also, that would be false advertising. It may not really communicate well to the public radio audience as a whole. So we'll move on to the subject at hand. And I want to start with, in 2008, Oklahoma's voters turned over control of state government to the Republican Party. And our focus this evening is not really about Democrats versus Republicans, but I want us to try to take a big picture view of that change and effect on the state and its people. And to begin our conversation, I'd like each of you, and I'm going to start with you, Andrew, to talk a moment about your assessment of the change in the state's political landscape just over the last couple of decades.
Well, thanks. It's great to be here. Great to see a bunch of people that we know and others we don't know, and be here with my good friend Chris. And I don't just say that because people say that sometimes at public things, yo, this is my friend. We actually are very good friends and really enjoyed our time together in the legislature. You know, of course, my involvement in politics is for a brief moment of these last couple of decades, but I have somewhat of an understanding. Of course, there's been rapid change in a partisan way in Oklahoma, going back to, I guess, probably the election of Lyndon Johnson. And I would say that probably the biggest thing I've seen in the last decade is a transition, at least in Oklahoma, it may happen in other states as well, of where I think it maybe was Tip O'Neill said that all politics are local. And so one of the dynamics that you had in Oklahoma as the Republican Party was becoming more and more popular, and where the Democratic Party, obviously, as many of us know, was more entrenched in the rural areas, that voters stopped voting for Democrats for president and then later on for Congress and U.S. Senate, but at the local level would continue to, despite what I feel about the voters saying about the national party, sort of vote local in that relationship. And I feel like really probably since the election of President Obama that has been flipped. And I think it was George Nye who said after 2010's midterm elections, I think I read this, or maybe I'm just making it up, I don't know, that actually now politics are not local, they're national. Mm. And I saw that in the election of a colleague that year. I had a colleague named J. Paul Gum from Durant, Oklahoma, very conservative Democrat, worked his district, I thought, very hard, passed himself, both when the Democrats were in the majority and when the Republicans were in the majority, lots of legislation, some of it very conservative. And we did a poll 2 or 3 weeks out from the election where his job approval was well over 50%. And for those of you who are not political animals like some of us have been, typically, an incumbent whose job approval is above 50% is considered safe. That's a good barometer. And he ended up losing that election by 13 points.
And it was a big surprise.
But then once we started to understand the sort of dynamics at play, I think really what was going on was sort of the opposite. I think you've done, what I imagine some of those voters done a pretty good job, happy with it, but sort of punishing him for his party affiliation that we really had never seen to that level. So I guess that has sort of been a slow transition, I guess I would say, from obviously Oklahoma's been moving Republican for many years, but I think in those last 4 to 6 years, you really just sort of seen the bottom fall out in that sense of party affiliation just sort of being paramount above everything for certain voters.
Chris?
Well, let me say, first of all, I appreciated the first 30 minutes of Andrew's response. What was the question again? let me tell you, it's an honor to get to be with you tonight and to have this discussion and to be with my good friend, Andrew Rice, and, of course, his wife, Apple, and all of you. I think the thing that I would like to respond with is, first, I'd like to preface my comments by saying I don't believe that either party has all the answers. I think it would be foolish to say that there's a monopoly on good ideas when it comes to political parties. And the thing that I hold, the hope that I hold out is that regardless of party affiliation, that our elected officials will remember that we're all Oklahomans first. That's very, very important to me. That being said, I think in about 2010, I read a book that really had an impact on me personally and the way that I wanted to not only try to serve myself, but also encourage those I support to serve as well. The name of the book is The Big Sort, S-O-R-T, and I know that several of you know of this book. A fellow by the name of Bill Bishop wrote the book, and he's a sociologist and researcher from Texas, and made several observations really about America, and I think that we could even bring this down to the state level as well. And his observation is basically this, that in our country, more and more and more, we are sorting ourselves out according to political beliefs, according to religious beliefs, just according to the way that we live our life. He states that in today's society, we get to choose our own brand of news and how we want that news presented and almost what we want that news to say. Mr. Bishop goes on to say, the problem is when we only interact with people who think just like we do, we tend to think that we're the only ones who are right and everyone else is wrong, to the point that we begin to become hostile toward an opposing idea. We don't know how to have that civil conversation or that civil discussion on what may be best in a particular scenario. And I say that to say that I think that our system of government is a good system of government. I think it's the best system of government, but we ought to be able to have intelligent, civil discussions about what is right and what is best and what is wrong and what is good when it comes to the people of Oklahoma, and not get caught up in a party ideology, regardless if you're a Republican or a Democrat. And so I think that the change, I would contend that in Oklahoma we're a very conservative state. We at least like to identify ourselves that way. And so probably, and I think we're going to get to this, but the bigger issue in Oklahoma from a party perspective is the split is not so much, even though it's trickled down from the national level, as Senator Rice alluded to. But I don't think, at least in my mind, the issue is so much Republican or Democrat as it is the divide may be more along the lines of urban versus rural in the state of Oklahoma. That's a dynamic that I see a lot and sort of the where I see the really emotional debates come from. That being said, I would go back to my opening statement, and that is that we're all Oklahomans first. And so I suspect that the pendulum sort of swings back and forth from, you know, which political party is really in charge based on, you know, some of the dynamics that may be happening at the national level and maybe even at the state level. And so regardless of which party is in charge, I think the important thing to remember is that we need to focus on the issues and put the people above politics.
I asked Dr. Bob Blackburn with the Oklahoma Historical Society about how he viewed some of the changes in both politics at the Capitol at 23rd Lincoln and the changes in the U.S. Census. And he talked about a little bit more, Chris, than that suburban versus rural divide in the state. He actually identified, which I thought was very astute, a suburban versus a combined urban-rural divide in the state. And let me start with you, Chris, and we'll go to Andrew. Do you see this and why or why not?
Well, I'm from Shawnee, currently still live in Shawnee, sort of feel like that Shawnee is the center of the universe and being suburban. And so I see that dynamic. And I think so. I think that one of the things that I got to experience as Speaker of the House was redistricting. And so we did our census in 2010, and then it was the legislature's responsibility to redraw the district lines in the following session according to where the people had moved. And what we had experienced is that we had fewer rural seats and more urban seats and suburban seats as a result of where people were living at today as opposed to where they were living 10 years ago. And so I do see the emergence of suburban Oklahoma as being more and more and more prevalent in our state. But I still think that the divide probably when it comes to issues and how you're going to represent your constituents is still clearly defined along urban versus rural.
Andrew?
Yeah, that's interesting. You know, I would say, you know, Dr. Blackburn studied this a lot more than me. Maybe my first reaction is that maybe it's more of a urban versus suburban versus rural on okay. some issues, that you have three distinct sort of worldviews that can, on some issues, all be conflicting. Absolutely now, even despite the supermajority of one political party and the legislature having a lot of control, you are seeing issues that are much more falling along urban-rural across party lines more. And even before we had that, when we had in my earlier years when we had a closer margin, there was a bill to incentivize charitable giving to public school foundations to help, in sort of a strange way, because they're going to public school foundations, as money to help kids get, essentially it's sort of a backdoor voucher for kids to get money through the foundation to get into private schools or charters or such. And it was something that I was persuaded by some Republicans to look at more seriously. And what we saw was a very distinct, unique alliance between urban, more liberal, progressive legislators and urban, fairly conservative legislators who saw the need for this in city schools more so than was being seen in suburban and or rural. And that was a very interesting fight when you had sort of Tom Adelson and Clark Jolly, who rarely agreed on anything, actually, you know, sort of joining forces. So we saw that. But I think that suburban block is going to be one that's really interesting to watch, because that's where really most, I mean, sometimes in politics they sort of conflate in that suburban with in Oklahoma, but really it's its own unique, you know, sort of Deer Creek, Bixby, you know, and they have, that's where most of the population is really going. It's not the core of Oklahoma City and the core of Tulsa, and there are going to be issues that are really particular to that, those communities that sometimes maybe aren't relatable in those others, but that's new territory.
One of the issues that, of course, hit everybody was the economic downturn in 2008, and you both were in the legislature at that time. It hit everyone hard, and over the last few years, Oklahoma has, by many measures, done better than other states, but still had its own fiscal issues. Andrew, we'll start with you, and I want to ask you, because you are an executive director of a nonprofit that provides health care to a large number of Oklahomans, how do you see the confluence of that economic change and the political climate in the state? With what you do?
Well, you know, actually, some of my education on that was from hearing an NPR story that was done. I think it was a national NPR story several years ago. By the way, tonight, before coming, I thought maybe my wife was tired from a long day, and I said, you know, you don't have to come. She said, are you kidding? KGOU is the only thing I listen to ever, so I'm going.
Thank you, Apple.
So, literally. So whenever I get in her car, it's not on the sports animal. I listen to the sports animal and KGOU. Right? So, you know, we have been, I think, you know, not to sound political as if I want to take things away from Republican fiscal policy in the state, I think a lot of it has been very lucky. You know, we are an energy state, and energy prices have helped a lot. The other thing that was very unique about Oklahoma City's economy, which is particularly better than statewide, of course, Tulsa's is lagged behind, is that we have banks that learned from the crises of the 1980s about reckless fiscal policies in their own practices, and they were more conservative during this last stretch. And then we also have a lot of public employees, which, of course, we could get into a whole other political conversation about how the unemployment rate is protected by people who work at Tinker and FAA and the Department of Human Services. You know, those are jobs, but they're government funded. So I think a lot of that has helped. I do think probably balanced budget requirement in state government and the rainy day fund, and those things have played an importance. I think that I think it may be a later question, but as far as the way there definitely seemed to be in 2008, especially because you saw the crash coming there right before, a month or so before President Obama was elected. Oklahoma, in those first couple of years of the recession, was very much protected, much more than the Rust Belt states, from the consequences. Although I will say that I do think, and again, this may sound like sour grapes, and I don't mean it to be, that when we have had our struggles with economic struggles that have come, I don't think it's necessarily always, among a lot of the electorate, been realistically attributed to national forces that, I mean, to local decisions, excuse me. It's sort of Obama and a lot of the congressional conflict. It's always sort of an easy scapegoat.
Well, that goes kind of back to what you were saying about
the nationalization
of the local politics.
I mean, you know, we saw cases of changes, and some of it is not rational, I don't think, but limited budgets in public schools being Obama's fault, where no, it was a budget decision in 2009 and 2010 because we had a downturn, and those were state decisions. But there's a lot that's sort of put on unpopular politics national. But, and you know, there's probably were times where when George Bush was president in Vermont and California and very blue states, similar dynamics happened as well. I don't think it's something that's unique to Oklahoma, but I definitely think that's part of it, of why the economic stuff is never really sort of, it's always sort of hurting the Democrats in Oklahoma.
Well, and Chris, you became speaker when this was all kind of happening. How do you think that the economic change that's kind of started in 2008 affected the political climate in the state?
Well, first of all, I can't take all the credit for a good economy in the state of Oklahoma. I'm kidding. It has nothing to do with me at all. But the reality is I do think that the fact that Oklahoma, and particularly Oklahoma City, was more recession-proof, if I could say it that way, and that our economy fared better than the national trend, had a lot to do, as Andrew said, with the major industries within our economy. Oil and gas played a key role in that. But in addition to – but I would say I would emphasize a little bit more – not necessarily what policies are the current legislature or the current legislatures, meaning when we were there, although we tried our best to advance solid policy. But I think that the fact that we do have to have a balanced budget, and we have a rainy day account, and we had protected that rainy day account for such a time as this, or as we were in at the time, played a factor, at least in protecting us as best we could. And being more conservative and not getting ahead of ourselves when times were good, I think that helped isolate or at least guard against part of the full impact of the recession. But then I think also it may have something to do with our geographic location, the fact that the recession hit hardest, it seemed like, on the East and West Coast, and the fact that we're in the middle, in the heartbeat of the nation. I think it was probably, maybe we lagged a little bit, maybe anywhere from 6 to 18 months from feeling the full effect of the recession once it got to Oklahoma and coming in state, and that gave us a little more time to prepare, maybe learn from what other states were doing and to plan a little bit better as well. So I think it is a combination of things, and to be fair, I don't think that the elected officials, whomever was there at the time, can take all the credit for that. I think that we were blessed and benefited from the vision of those who had gone before us, as well as just the current situation in Oklahoma that sort of protected us.
As a native Oklahoman, I have to also, after hearing you both talk about that, I also wonder, though, is there just something almost innate in us as a state that is always waiting for the other shoe to fall, that no matter how good the times are? I mean, we went through the Dust Bowl. We went through the 80s. I remember a friend of mine, a journalist at an Oklahoma City television station, had a bumper sticker in the 80s that taped to her desk that said, "Live Dangerously, Bank in Oklahoma." and I love that. But is there something in our DNA that keeps us conservative like that, Andrew?
Yeah, I wouldn't know.
You're asking the wrong fella.
Chris, that question.
Although I do think I'm conservative in ways that are not sure appropriately labeled anymore. I do think part of it is that mentality. You know, there is the independence that came out of past struggles and not necessarily being dependent on others. But I've seen, though, that mentality, and I know I was aware of that growing up. I would say that I think now that I sense that maybe a sign of progress is, I don't sense that as much as far as within mm-hmm. the culture. You know, particularly I'm much more Oklahoma City-centric in my sort of what I'm engaged in all levels. And I sort of get this sense of, with all the good news and things that we see going on in our community in Oklahoma City that, frankly, I never thought would take place outside of the Thunder, and I'm a big Thunder fan, I think there's a little bit of that, hey, maybe this isn't a mirage, that actually some of this is going to stay, you know? The guy who was scoring 38 points the other night is going to be an NBA legend, actually lives in a portion of downtown that 10 years ago was a vacant lot.
Yeah.
That's a good point.
You know, I mean, Kevin Durant lives in a brownstone in an area of Oklahoma City that no one wanted even, they couldn't give that property away. You know, so I think some of what that psyche I'm seeing is sort of that, hey, some of this is built to last and we've got good times. But there is that sort of mentality of, you know, something bad's going to happen. I think that could be more to do with tornadoes and grass fires than anything.
Chris, what do you think about that?
You know, my initial reaction would be that more than sort of a doomsday, and that's my word, mentality, I think that we're a much more resilient bunch. I think that resiliency and determination just a strong can do, we're going to make it through the tough times sort of attitude plays a large role in the way that we think and the way that we approach various issues when it comes to planning and being more on the conservative side. I think that being reluctant to not get ahead of ourselves is more how I would describe it, and I think that just comes from past experiences of realizing that there may be tough times ahead and we need to plan accordingly.
I wanted to kind of drill down a little bit into this economic issue specifically for each of you and have you address how the economy and how what's going on in the area affects the work that your nonprofits do. Andrew, we'll start with you on that.
Sure. This is something that we've been looking at a lot, because not only do you have still the lingering effects of a bad economy, but you also have state government that is, because of the political nature, is very committed to reducing its size. There's been somewhat of a priority to try to protect revenue going into safety net type of programs, but it's still, they've been cut quite a bit as well. And with that, and again, this is very Oklahoma City centric, you've seen something that we can now talk about more openly, I think, that everybody's been worried about, which is you've seen the reduction of charitable giving from one of our large community partners, Chesapeake Energy, which frankly was almost absurdly generous. I don't mean that as a negative, but safety net organizations getting unbelievably large gifts from them, and then other community partners and corporations really not wanting to be outdone, and they try to match. With that going away, which is inevitable, maybe it was going to happen anyway if they didn't have the problems at Chesapeake that they've had, combined with the reduction in state revenue, it puts, I think, a larger amount of pressure on nonprofits that are in the safety net, especially when you have the dynamic on state government right now, which is a lot of lack of cooperation, which I guess would be a kind way of saying it, between state government and the federal government, and turning away more safety net money. It just is something that we're trying to figure out. How do you sustainably support your services when a lot of those revenue streams are going away? We'll see whether state government and the politics adjust to that. And I got to imagine it could be worse in some rural areas, but it's definitely something that a lot of nonprofits are very worried about.
Chris?
Sure. So I think the great thing about having the opportunity to work in and with a nonprofit is being able to truly be where the rubber meets the road, so to speak, when it comes to the real-life needs that individuals in Oklahoma are facing. And I would just say that for me, having had the opportunity and the privilege to serve in the legislature and work on policy is much more from a 30,000 foot view, and now I'm right down on a foot view, or
13th and Broadway,
yeah,
right?
Exactly. and I can just tell you, for us and for me, the issue that really captured my heart and my attention is the belief that we can do better in Oklahoma when it comes to the issue of incarceration and the impact that it's having on families and individuals and children of incarcerated parents and so on and so forth. And the fact that unfortunately right now Oklahoma leads the nation in female incarceration, and maybe third or fourth highest in male incarceration, depending on whose statistics you look at, and the impact that has on the individual. And then also, given the number of low-risk, nonviolent offenders who are currently incarcerated, people who according to the assessments do not pose a threat to public safety, and the amount of money that we're spending on incarceration as opposed to the amount of money that we're spending on treatment or prevention or mental health services or substance abuse services is mind-boggling to me. And so I truly want to be able to be in a situation where we can demonstrate in the community what that better way may look like, meaning that for the person that has been impacted by the criminal justice system, if they have the proper education or the proper job training or the proper assistance, and they can find meaningful work and get on the path to self-sufficiency and become a contributing member of our society, it not only helps that individual and helps the state from a taxpayer standpoint, but it also helps their children's chances to be successful exponentially. And so having the opportunity to be out and to work in the nonprofit world makes me realize just how important that work is and how necessary it is to really truly helping our state reach its full potential, both from a financial standpoint and also from a human resource standpoint.
Go ahead, Andrew.
I want to add to that. I want to plug something Chris is involved with because I'm on a retainer to make him look good.
So I need all the help I can get.
The Remerge program here in Oklahoma County, which is started through the United Way, which Chris's legislation that he passed was helped make possible. At the graduation ceremony that Chris spoke at that I went to a couple months ago, were the first graduates, the female graduates. So these are nonviolent offenders who have been diverted out of the county jail. They're on their way through the correctional system to incarceration. Nonviolent offenses, they must have children. It was really dramatic and inspiring to see these women graduate, and it was very clear. You could just see the dollar signs of the amount of money we put in a responsible way to divert them, to get their lives back on track, to give them skills, and diverting them away from what was a much more expensive future for the state of incarceration, DHS custody for their children, all these things, tax users, as our good friend Harry Coates says, rather than taxpayers. All four of these graduates have jobs. But again, that program takes resources. And there's a lot of partners involved in that program.
For sure.
So that's the thing. I mean, it takes money, though, to sometimes get these success stories, but you have to invest on the front end.
I'm going to start, Andrew, with you on this. So what do you see as the challenges that face a supermajority and how that works in terms of governing in Oklahoma? And I know you were there in that transition and in that tie year in the Senate. And then, Chris, we're going to ask the same question of you.
I wish I had firsthand experience of being in the supermajority. I will say, in preference that we were just talking about this beforehand, the year that I got elected to the Senate, 2006, actually was a very unique situation because we entered into, by the results of the elections, into a 24-24 tie. And so you may recall both caucuses got some lawyers and lawyered up, and we agreed into a power-sharing agreement where we had equal power in the Senate. The House had become Republican 2 years before, I believe. And so that's the only thing I'd ever known at that point. But it was fascinating because it was like nuclear deterrence during the Cold War. It was like, you know, we can destroy everything you want to do, and you can destroy everything we want to do, and we can't go back to our districts having done absolutely nothing, you would assume. Although sometimes you wonder.
You might try
if you
that.
You can do that. It seems like
that.
Some people do that, and they keep getting reelected. But and it actually, you know, it worked. It caused, on some issues, some reasonable coming to the middle and compromising and working things out. And it was pretty interesting. So that's sort of, for me, maybe an unattainable, you know, opposite of the supermajority. I think the problem with the supermajority, regardless of who's in power, is really sort of made worse by gerrymandering of the districts. And I'll give Chris credit in the House. There's always politics and redistricting, no matter which party's in charge. That's just sort of inevitable, unfortunately, unless you have an independent commission who does it. I mean, if you have politicians doing it, there's going to be politics. But the House was much less political than the Senate in the way they redistricted. But the problem now is you've got seats that are just very Republican or very Democrat. You do not have split districts where you've got a good combination where the elected person sort of feels like, you know, I need to sort of try to meet people halfway. I've got a diverse district. I need to sort of try to find the common ground on certain issues. You're just sort of incentivized to be, you know, we all want to be popular. Politicians all want to be popular. That's why we're screwed up and go into this business.
We'll have Apple up in a moment to talk about that.
But be popular to, you know, where the majority of your district is. And that leads to supermajorities, I think. And it makes it harder because there are people within the majority that want to compromise quietly back when you're getting coffee at the back of the floor. But it's hard for them when the pressure is on from a very partisan district. I don't know if I really answered your question. But.
Well, that's good. And Chris, I know you led at a time whenever there was this large majority, or as I referred to it to the minority leader. I said, you have a record minority. How was that? What do you think that does mean for governing?
You know, I think the danger, first of all, I believe wholeheartedly that the rules that govern our legislative process exist to protect the minority. I believe that our rules exist to protect the minority, and sometimes it's very easy if you're in the supermajority situation just to sort of bulldoze your way through and not give time or pause to listen to opposing points of view. And I would just go back to a statement that I tried to articulate at the beginning, and that if you're only talking to and interacting with people who think just like you do, you're going to miss out on a good idea. You're going to miss out on the opportunity to grow and to really study and to really consider what may be the best solution for the situation that you're dealing with. And so I think the danger for our leaders, any leaders, and I would say this about if it were a Democrat supermajority or a Republican supermajority, is to not get too comfortable and feel like that you don't have to really study or understand a different perspective to know what may be the best solution in any given situation. I think that you have to be intentional about doing your homework if you're in the supermajority and really considering what may be in the best interest of the state and the people of the state, and not just blindly follow a party agenda or a party platform, because, again, I would go back to say that neither party has a monopoly on the best ideas.
But I do know that our audience here today does have a monopoly on the best ideas and the best questions, hopefully, for sure. So Jim Johnson, KJOU Program Director, has the microphone. So if you have a question you'd like to ask to any of us, all of us, please don't be shy and join in. This is your chance to be on KJOU. Front row.
Y'all have talked about urban, suburban.
Hold your mic just a little bit closer if you don't mind.
You've talked about urban, suburban, and rural. And I'm going to talk about water and no water. And you all haven't mentioned that at all. And I think that's where we're going to break down now. I think a definition of a third world country is one that gives all of its resources away to others without benefit to the location where we are. And we've seen this with our oil and gas reserves, and we have an amazing blessing of oil and gas. And our water, though, is what really defines our state with respect to tourism, with respect to a glass of water that we drink. And this state is dividing out into water and no water. And in fact, this week in the Journal Record, or this week or last week, even the Indian Cultural Heritage Center here in Oklahoma City becomes part of the water situation. Mm-hmm. And it becomes a pawn in where we're headed with who gets the water. And as people in southern Oklahoma, I'm rural Oklahoma, but I'm also suburban Oklahoma. I'm Norman and I'm Ardmore. And I think that urban and suburban have lost sight of what some of rural Oklahoma is about. And we're ready to sell our water, we're ready to sell our oil and gas, and not really benefit Oklahoma and become what we should be with these resources.
Well, and water is a very complicated issue that involves not only local entities, there are state issues, there are regional water districts. We're under regulation in a agreement with Oklahoma, Texas, Louisiana, Arkansas about our water. What do you all think? Just talk about what you think about our water policy, but also more. I think your bigger question is how does Oklahoma handle its resources and our riches that we have, and how do we use those to benefit our residents? Yeah, do we sell them to the highest bidder, or what do we do?
If I may, I think your question is extremely timely, and I would even go as far to say that Oklahoma has truly been blessed by extraordinary leadership in years past, people like Robert S. Kerr and others who really had a vision and understood the importance of developing a 50-year water plan for our state, and they were able to do that. And I only mention that to tell you that we are at the end of our current 50-year water plan now. And it's in the state's best interest to develop a new 50-year water plan, at least, for the state of Oklahoma. And I think that if we really would get serious about doing that and focus on what it's going to take to meet the needs of our state, within our state, it would probably help us to focus on the things that we need to focus on. And the question wouldn't be whether we sell to out of state. We wouldn't even have that conversation until we had a plan in place to meet our needs with the resources that we've been blessed with. I would say this, that and from a very simple perspective, that I look at the divide between rural and suburban and urban, as you said, over the issue of water. I consider the debate between the various regions, water districts within our state. I consider the dialogue that's going on between federally recognized tribes and water rights concerning those entities. And nations, as well as counties and all different levels of government. And here's what I know, just based on the studies, there is more than enough water in the state of Oklahoma if we could just work together and figure out how to ultimately meet the needs and utilize it in a way that's truly going to benefit our state collectively. That's what I think.
And are any lessons from that?
It's not an issue that I really am well knowledgeable about. I'll say that I do think it's careful for us to make sure that we just don't see dollar signs with resources first when we have sustainability issues moving forward in regards to water. And so, but it's something that I will say at the legislative level, and one of the reasons why there's lots going on in the districts and in the local areas. But one of the things that was unique about this, and it happens on some other issues at the Capitol, and I don't know if Chris's experience was the same, but this is one of those issues when it really came to a head every session, really a lot of times was taking place behind closed doors. Not, sure. I don't think intentionally, but it just was one of those deals where, as an urban legislator, where the chamber wasn't really talking to us about it, the business chamber of commerce, we'd sort of find out about some issue on the last day of the last week of session that had sort of been discussed and that usually got stopped, the bill got stopped. So I think there's a lot of transparency going on in water districts at regional meetings, but weirdly at the legislature, and I haven't been up there for a couple of years, my experience in this last couple of years was that there wasn't really a lot of transparency about the decisions that were being made on water. And that's one of the reasons why I think it headed to court.
Well, and one of the things that, and just real quickly, and be thinking of your questions, I'm going to ask another one while you guys think of yours, but what effect do you think term limits has on an issue like water? Because that is a complex issue. It really is long-ranging. I mean, I know, what was it, the last lawsuit that was settled with a Native American tribe, I think it was in New Mexico, and it was like 60 years.
Oh, I think for me in particular, that's one of the reasons why my knowledge level on it is not real adequate. And I think that term limits in general, even though my seat I won was because it became open from term limits, and an open seat in politics is always easier to win than beating an incumbent. I think that you are taking people who are learning a lot about issues. Usually legislators have certain subject areas that they get more interested in by what committees they're on or chair, and you're building up a knowledge base. You're knowing the things that are done to certain things that are being amended and changed in certain statutes year after year. And you understand the logic behind that, of corrections we're making, the unintended consequences of something we passed 4 years ago, and then you're forcing them into retirement, so to speak, and you're having someone, thank goodness for our staff in the House and the Senate, who've been there for many years, who know the history. But I think that it can make the legislature very inefficient.
What do you think?
Because you're
that?
Having people who don't really know a lot of what the history has gone on, and there's a lot of catching up that just can't be done in a short period of time.
Chris, what do you think about that?
Well, certainly, I believe that there are pros and cons to term limits, and there's no question that a con is the amount of expertise you lose within the legislative body itself. And in my experience, in a matter of 12 years or 8 years, I guess, since term limits took effect, I've seen the emergence of the influence of special interest groups and lobbyists at the Capitol. And you know as well as I do that knowledge is power. And for those individuals who know how the process works and how to get things done, and you know, the information that's important tend to be the most effective entities in the system. And so it can be staff, and I believe that we're very fortunate to have the staff that we have. And with Andrew, I'm thankful for him. But equally concerning, I think, to me, is the impact or the influence of people who have an agenda, the special interest sort of agenda from a lobbyist perspective, and it does concern me.
Yeah, I mean, the most senior members of the legislature right now were elected in 2002.
Questions? Question? Jim's bringing the microphone around. And as they say on the floor of the legislature, this is a question, not a...
I'm not going to make a statement. But I am a small business owner, and today I received an email from my insurance provider stating that because Mary Fallon has denied the Medicaid assistance from the federal government, that we will not be able to continue insure Oklahoma in after the first of next year. Now, I have four employees on insurance, and two of them are in Insure Oklahoma, and you know it's a big ticket. For everybody who pays insurance for their employees, and also it's a big ticket if I just decide, okay, no insurance for anybody. So I'd like to entertain your comments on how it affects both the nonprofits, who will maybe pick up the tab, and the and why would we refuse to take that money so that we can do Insure Oklahoma for our businesses, who one party presumes to say they like. So
I think we're going to go with Variety Care. Obviously, you're in the insurance, the insurance business, but the healthcare industry. What do you think about that?
I need to just try to make this brief because I really would like to talk about this for about 20 minutes. Medicaid in Oklahoma currently is very restrictive. Each state has the ability to adjust their eligibility requirements. Most people in Oklahoma currently today that are on Medicaid are children up to 185% of poverty, I believe, or maybe it's 285%.
And give us a dollar figure on that.
You know, generally, that's a family of four. That's $30,000, $28,000 for a family of four. An individual, that would be about $14,000, $15,000. That's top end. Children that are in families of that income, pregnant mothers who will then lose coverage when the baby's born of that same level, and then parents, adults with children in the home, not childless adults, who are at 36%, which is essentially part-time at the Dollar Tree. So my point is, very few adults are covered by Medicaid. So that population that Medicaid expansion would cover is really our biggest hole of the uninsured currently, which is mostly working, some unemployed adults who have no insurance coverage. Their employers don't cover it, or they don't have the out-of-pocket expense to buy it. So the reason why, when the Affordable Care Act became law, programs like Insure Oklahoma would not be able to continue because Insure Oklahoma is dependent on a large extent of Medicaid dollars. And the Affordable Care Act was going to cover that same population through a new means, Medicaid expansion, meaning you can't have both. But then the Supreme Court and the Chief Justice, in their decision, gave the option for states to choose whether they were going to expand Medicaid or not. In the letter that the Center for Medicaid and Medicare Services sent, I hope this is making sense, it said, it would have to cease if you do not adapt and alter the program along these lines to meet the needs of what Medicaid expansion would do. So we will see. The initial response from the governor yesterday seemed very hostile to altering Insure Oklahoma. But there is the option. More conservative states that are ruled by politicians who are not fans of the Affordable Care Act have chosen an alternative that would be along the lines of expanding Insure Oklahoma. Arkansas right next door has done just that. So I'm hopeful that it's not going to be something that happens, that state government through the legislature will adapt that law to meet coverage requirements. Eligibility requirements will go up to cover that population. Employees in your organization would still be covered, but that's going to be the decision of the legislature, really more than the governor. I mean, it's sort of a political mirage that the governor, I think it's sort of, she's out, but really, laws are passed by the legislature and signed by the governor. And so it's going to be the legislature who's really going to have to decide whether they do that.
Chris, what about the population that, that team serves, and how does that relate to who you work with on that, as you said, that rubber meets the road area?
Well, again, having the opportunity to do what I do and the privilege of working with the people that I work with, I can't think of a person that this issue doesn't affect, including our employees as well. I believe that we have 6 employees that take advantage of the Insure Oklahoma. So I'm right there with you. And I don't understand. I can just tell you, if I'm going to be candid, and I want to be candid with you, that while Andrew is exactly right, it's ultimately the legislature's, you know, decision. When you have the leader saying we're not going to do this, it makes it twice as hard for the legislature to stand up and say, okay, let's consider what we should do. It's almost a making the decision for them, and it makes it very, very difficult. And so I personally wish that we had not responded the way that we did and that we would consider. And I think that we I think before it's all said and done, we're going to wish we had reconsidered, and we likely will, because ultimately, to answer your question, you know, it's no secret that Oklahoma has some of the worst health indicators, health statistics of any state in the nation. And part of that, to be fair, I think has to do with individual responsibility, and we need to take some responsibility ourselves. But a big part of it has to do with education and access to quality health care services from a primary care and a preventative care sort of standpoint, so that we can begin to train our residents and their children on what healthy habits are and how to maintain a healthy lifestyle. It's hard, if not impossible, to do that when you don't have access to health care. And for us just to say no, and again, I'm giving you my honest opinion based purely on the politics of the issue, is not fair. It's not fair to the state of Oklahoma and to the citizens who truly could benefit from a program like Insure Oklahoma, even if it needs to be tweaked a little bit.
To not do anything to cover this population is fiscally, it's morally as well, but it's fiscally irresponsible, because right now that population, the adult diabetic hypertensive, it doesn't have coverage, so we're not spending any monthly premium on that. They have episodic encounters at the emergency department when things get bad, and at some point it's going to get bad where they have to get admitted, which is every hospital's worst nightmare, that you have someone who has no insurance who you have to admit, and that's $200,000 to the taxpayer. So why don't you spend $350 a month getting them access to primary care? Isn't that a better fiscal investment? It just seems, and so that's really what the issue.
And that will be our next conversation coming up next month. No, it is vital. Any other questions before we one more question before we wrap up here?
I'm very concerned about civil society. We've all heard the analogy of the three-legged stool: the private sector, the government, and the nonprofit sector. It seems like things are very badly out of balance now. Government is shrinking, business is, in Oklahoma at least, thriving, and in the stock markets. But the nonprofit sector, the third pillar of our civil society, is really seems under attack, and it's filled so many governmental functions. What is your prognosis for the future of civil society in Oklahoma?
And Chris, we'll start with you.
So thank you for the question, and let me just go back to my motivation for working in the nonprofit sector at this point. And I want to go back to the issue of incarceration, and in particular reentry. You all know that statewide, our reentry, we don't have a reentry program. We don't have a system in place to help people once they've paid their debt, served their time, become, you know, productive, contributing members of our community. In fact, what we do in Oklahoma today when a person gets ready to be released is we give them $50 and a bus ticket and a pat on the back, and we say good luck. And statistically, we see them right back in the system. And so the nonprofit, at least, for the nonprofit and for the related entities that I get to work with, we're trying to fill that gap and to say, you know what, with just the proper education, with the proper job training, with the proper equipping, with the proper social services and assistance, this person can add value. This person can, as Andrew said, become a taxpayer, if you will. And they want to be. They want to be. And so I think maybe if we can demonstrate that better way, then our leaders will point and say, hey, that's a good use of our resources. And that those are some things that we ought to consider more of and less of what we're currently doing on that particular issue. But I would say the same must be true for Variety Care and other nonprofits that are taking up the slack in another but related issue, social issue.
Yeah, it's hard to predict. There are great organizations doing great work, some with a lot of resources, some with limited resources. I would say that the thing I'm concerned with is the distance of, and I can't claim, as much as I like to rail about things I don't like, I can't claim to have always been good about this as well. But there's too much distance between policymakers and, like Chris was saying, where the rubber meets the road, the one-foot level. I was with a principal today at an event in the afternoon of a very large public high school in Oklahoma City in an underserved area. And he said, it's interesting, because I was asking, what are your bigger challenges? He says, he was going through, because, but what's interesting is we had some people in the community who were really against the DREAM Act. This is an area of town. It's heavily Hispanic. And some of these kids came to the United States when they were one. They're not citizens, but they've lived here 98% of their life. He says, but when some of these individuals came and got involved with projects in our school and they got to know these children, their whole position on the DREAM Act changed because it was relational and real. It wasn't. And the thing that concerns me about the government sector and the private sector, I mean, I'm grateful for the private sector when they adopt a school or such, but that's still not the same as really understanding the society in which you live, the community in which you live. I'm worried that there's just not, it's not in touch. In Oklahoma, right, when there are two large free dental clinics every year, public dental clinics, this is something I didn't know anything about, this need. When they take place in Oklahoma, people line up at 8 o'clock the night before and they camp out all night to get dental care. Now, those of you in this room who may have dental insurance, no, it's not really insurance. It's like a prepaid plan for getting your cleanings, but if you have to get two crowns like I just did, you spend a lot of out-of-pocket money. I just spent a lot of, and I'm lucky to be able to have the resources to pay for that. And I sat there and thought, wow, what has become of our country where access to dental care is a privilege? And I did not realize, When we were involved with, we said, don't show up until 3 a.m. because it gets, but they showed up at 8 o'clock the night before and the news came out and they were lined up along the fence at the fairgrounds like animals, waiting to get their teeth pulled because their teeth are out of control. So again, I think there are lots of policymakers that would care about that, but the difference between telling them about that in their office or over coffee and having them come to the free dental clinic at midnight and talking to people. Those people don't come to the office. They didn't come talk to us on lobbying day. There are a lot of citizens that did. The most vulnerable usually don't have access to us. So that's the thing that concerns me about civil society is this distance between.
Well, and I would like to say I think that one of our goals at KGOU, Karen Holp, and I'm looking at you, is to continue that and to elevate these kinds of discussions and those in the future. Chris Steele with the Education and Employment Ministry and Andrew Rice with Variety Care Foundation. Thank you both so much for, first of all, your service to the people of Oklahoma, your time, and your insight. Thank you. Thank you.